This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Principal to me is one of like, the most undesirable jobs I can imagine.
Seriously.
Yeah, we gotta get that money up.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, Janie Blue Ivy Skull.
That's my name. I'm going by it from now on.
Blue Ivy, huh?
Yeah.
This is the new name by, who is this?
It's Beyonce and Jay-Z.
And Jay-Z, yes, of course. All right, now.
Blue Ivy Carter, I believe.
Blue Ivy.
That's Jay-Z's real last name, I think.
Carter. Now, in Blue Ivy, so Ivy, is this the middle name?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's two words. I'm not sure why. I'm sure it has some symbolic meaning.
But it would never go alone. You wouldn't just call the baby Blue.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Or maybe this will just go by Ivy.
Right.
Because that's an actual name as opposed to a color.
Yes. Or, right. Is there such thing as blue ivy out there in nature? Do we have any idea what this is about, Janie?
No.
All right.
None whatsoever.
Because we know there's going to now be a bunch of babies out there named Blue Ivy.
Very true.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's interesting, you know, tying this back to education, you know, there was that interesting study a few years ago showing about how kids performed in school dependent in part on their names. Like, that's names that were more stereotypically African-American. Those kids ended up doing worse.
Yeah, that was one of the Freakonomics things, wasn't
that's
it?
Correct.
Yeah, that
you
kids
betcha.
With, yeah, all classic right. names. And then it would kind of go in waves and that, you know, lower income and poor performing kids would eventually take on those names and right. drag them down.
Exactly. Okay, hey, last to cover. It has been a big education week. It's like everybody saved up their ammunition over the holidays and just let it fly this week. Lots of interesting studies, happenings, events. We're going to talk about it all. We're going to play part in the Gadfly. We're going to hear the Research Minute. We're going to hear what's up with that. Let's get to it. Ty, let's play part in the Gadfly.
Well, this week we released the cost of online learning. Mike, what did our analysts find, and does it mean that taxpayers and schools can save money by moving to digital learning?
Okay, so now this study, this is the fourth in a series of five papers we're doing on digital learning. This one looks at the costs of full-time virtual schools and the costs of these so-called blended learning schools, where kids are spending some of their time online during the school day. This is a huge issue because a lot of states have debated whether or not they should be paying full price for these kinds of schools, or whether or not they can get some kind of discount. A big debate in states. And what we did, we had the Parthenon Group go out there and talk to all kinds of people in the field and experts and estimate what these things cost today. Not necessarily what they should cost, but what they cost today. And what they found is that, in fact, full-time virtual schools on average cost about two-thirds as much as traditional brick-and-mortar schools, about $6,500 instead of $10,000. Blended learning on average is more around $9,000. So you can do more for less if you would go to online learning. Now, if you want to spend the full $10,000, you'd get more, ideally. You'd get smaller teacher-student ratios. You'd get maybe better content that they can purchase. But today, it does look like you can use online learning to save some bucks.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, Ty's question is whether or not policymakers should see it as a way to save money. And you can look at it either way. Either, yes, they should see it as a way to save money because that'll encourage kind of more of it and more innovation, or no, because then, you know, you're not considering the quality of the program. But for me, it's digital learning gives, you know, presents an opportunity in two different ways. It's saving money and it's improving schools. So if you look at it in both ways and you try to hold both of those accountable, then I think, yeah, of course people should look at it as a way to save money, because that really will encourage, you know, more people saying, what can we do with this and what can we do with it to improve schools and save money?
Yeah. Now, the people who actually run these schools would hate to hear this, right? Because, and I understand, they say, look, we want as much money as the traditional public schools and we'll use it more efficiently and productively. And so, especially the blended learning schools, what a school like Rocket Ship does is says, okay, we're going to get the same per pupil that other people get. We're not raising a lot of philanthropic dollars on top of it. We're going to use that same per pupil. We're going to save money by having kids spend part of their day online instead of in front of an expensive certified teacher. But as a result, we're going to be able to pay our teachers more, and we're going to be able to keep our class sizes lower when they are with the teacher. And so this is a way to boost effectiveness with the same amount of money.
But I think it's a false dichotomy to say you can only spend less if you're giving less services. You know, for them, they're spending the same amount of money and they might be improving services, but it doesn't mean you could spend less and improve services just because they're not doing it.
Right.
So I think it absolutely should be in the forefront of people's minds. Right. This could be a way to save money. How can we do it?
Now, the other issue is that, a lot of the for-profit interests are involved in this, and that cuts both ways. I mean, people don't like the idea of Ron Packard, the head of K12.com, making $3 million, $4 million bucks a year. On the other hand, if you don't have any margins here, if you don't have some money that that, you know, if it's not possible for for-profits to make their investment back, they will pull their investments. Mm-hmm. And so this is the trick is, you know, you don't want to waste taxpayer dollars, but you also don't want to cut it to the bone if you want to, unless you want to see some of this innovation disappear. So this is the balancing act, policymakers. We hope to look at the report and look at the findings, but also all the nuances and caveats around it, of which there are many.
Yes.
Okay, Ty, question number two.
All right. Well, speaking of policymakers, last Friday, House Republican leaders released two draft bills that would overhaul NCLB. What's new in these proposals, and are we any closer to a new NCLB?
Well, Janie, as you would guess, if you pay attention to politics, this bill is to the right of where the Senate came out.
Indeed.
In a bill that came out last year. That was the bipartisan Harkin-Enzi bill. It's also somewhat to the right of where Lamar Alexander came out, along with some other Senate GOP folks. In the fall. But they're not so far away. I mean, the main thing to take away from all these proposals is they're all in the same ballpark. I mean, this is now a debate between the 40-yard lines, maybe the 45-yard lines.
I mean, I would agree with that, but I think the differences are still significant. I mean, they're not huge differences in name, but I think they would have very significant impacts. That would be very different.
What do you have in mind?
I mean, in terms of, all right, saying what this new proposal says that, you know, there will be no federal interventions for the very worst performing schools. Like, you don't have to hold the bottom 5% or 15% or whatever accountable like some of the other ones. And I think that really would have a significant impact. Maybe not, and I'm not saying impact in terms of improving schools. I'm just saying impact on policy and the way that things work and how much money gets spent.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is a big deal, I think.
Well, so this is the question. I mean, so, yes, in the Senate, they continue to say, well, you've got to do these four or five things to address your failing schools and all, you know, we're going to get tough kind of stuff. The Lamar Alexander bill has a little more flexible language in there. And then the House says, you know, do it if you want, but we don't care, you know, you don't have to. And yes, that on its face is a big difference, except for the fact that none of this stuff works anyways, right?
Yeah.
And there's no way for the federal government to actually enforce these tough love sanctions on states and schools. So to me, that's a difference that's more on paper than in reality. You know, same thing around teacher evaluations. This one, surprisingly, they came out in favor of mandating teacher evaluations, including student performance in that. The Senate bill in the end did not. And look, this is again one of these issues. I almost can guarantee you that at the end of the day, this is not going to be included in a final bill because there's not enough Republicans who like the idea of mandating it. And there's not going to be enough Democrats who want to cross the teacher unions who don't like it from a political standpoint or policy standpoint. So, I mean, at this point, I feel like we just have a lot of positioning going on. I think it's unfair for Democrats to say that the Republicans are mucking up the process when, you know, they come out with a bill that I think is in the ballpark. And likewise, you know, there's no reason the Republicans shouldn't be working harder to work with the Democrats. I'm saying, people, get the thing done. You're not that far apart.
Yeah.
Well, moving to the state level, last week, the New Hampshire state legislature passed a law requiring that school districts give parents the opportunity to seek alternatives to any aspect of the school curriculum they find objectionable. Is this a win for parent rights, or will it just benefit creationists and extremists?
I think this one's a dicey one. I mean, at first glance, you think, oh, yeah, you're going to get all these whack jobs saying, oh, they don't want, you know, their kids learning evolution and things that most people would consider pretty core to a general education. But at the same time, you know, we've always had the option for parents to pull out their students and homeschool them. And, you know, we keep talking about how we want parental input and parental choice. And I think restricting that would probably be the wrong answer here.
So I'm a little confused about exactly what this does, right? I mean, so let's say a teacher assigns a book in high school. And some parent says, I don't want my kid reading that book, right? I mean, they've always been able to just complain to the school, right? I mean, does this law give them some kind of right to say, well, my kid doesn't have to do that assignment?
I think so. I mean, I think the general idea is that if they can come up with a comparable alternative, which God knows what that means, then, yeah, they can kind of swap out that book for something else that would, in theory, you know, educate the children the same way.
Yeah, it is a tricky issue. I mean, you know, in my ideal world, parents would be making choices among different kinds of schools that, you know, in some schools would teach Huckleberry Finn and maybe some other schools would choose another, Mark Twain book. And you know, parents who all liked Huckleberry Finn would be in one school and the ones that didn't were in another school, right? And so you'd have choice as a part of that. But in reality, especially in a place like New Hampshire where we're talking about mostly small towns, they're not going to support lots of schools, we have the one-size-fits-all problem, which is you know, schools got to make decisions about what to teach. You don't want to force them to teach only things that not a single parent will find objectionable. This is a really tricky one. And yeah. I mean, I wonder what motivated this. If it was the, you know, intelligent design stuff around evolution or some of the issues around global warming that motivated the more political stuff, or if this was just pitched as a parents' rights thing.
I don't know. I mean, even in the kind of scenario that you describe where you have different schools focused on different things, I would always be nervous that you wouldn't have the controversies in those schools because they would be stuck in a certain mindset. And, you know, while this option might remove the controversy for some children, I don't think it would remove controversy necessarily for all children, which I would get nervous about if you have schools very focused on a certain set curriculum or agenda. Which, having gone to a Catholic school myself my entire life, like, you know, I very much went to a school with a set kind of mindset, and this is what we're going to teach, and parents, you know, just kind of signed on to it and then, right. you know, didn't challenge it.
Right.
So, but I would certainly say there are some things I was not exposed to. So
well, we're not going to resolve this one today, unfortunately, on the podcast, but it is an interesting one. We'll watch this and see if other states pick up on this as well. Okay, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thank you, Mike. Always a pleasure.
You know, just before we went on the air here for your part of the segment, we're pretty sure that the president's helicopter just flew overhead.
Woo.
Yeah, this is part of the excitement of getting to be in Washington, D.C.
Get to glimpse him from afar in the helicopter.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
We take these things for granted here.
Right. It's not a terrorist. It's the president.
Well, that's good. That is, we do always sometimes think that,
that
to
too,
ourselves.
Right.
Okay, so what do you have for us this week?
So this week we have the next installment of the Gates-funded Measures of Effective Teaching, or MET project. Everybody kind of knows about this one. It's basically trying to figure out what effective teachers do. This installment examines the reliability of classroom observation instruments in detecting differences between effective and ineffective teaching. Analysts review 5 different classroom observation instruments applied to roughly 7,500 lesson videos, about 1,300 participating teachers, and about 45,000 students in 6 large urban school districts. The bottom line finding, while each classroom observation is positively correlated to student achievement data, that's both on the state test and an independent test, they also use the Stanford 9, the observations by themselves pale in comparison to value-added measures in predicting effectiveness. I don't think that's too surprising. When multiple measures are combined, however, they do offer greater predictive power, but it's only slightly better than the student achievement gains alone. It takes multiple observations, as a matter of fact, 4 in this study, to get decent reliability. There's been some brouhaha in the blogosphere about spin and whatnot. Personally, I think that all these technical studies really have a hard time kind of saying what the main finding is in a very clear and concise way. So I don't want to beat up on them too much for that.
Okay, so Amber, I've got some questions. I've been trying to figure out what this is all about here, especially this debate that you reference, which is between Jay Green and the Gates people about what they did or did not find. So let's start from this initial question. Why can't we just use test scores and value-added gain scores to judge whether or not teachers are effective? If we're saying that teacher effectiveness is boosting student achievement, why not just use the test scores? Is the assumption because you have such a small sample, especially if you're looking at just one classroom, one year over time, that the data are not reliable enough?
Right. So there's some noise. Obviously, this has been the debate with value-added for a while, is that, you know, you've got to have multiple data points for teachers. You want that sort of longitudinal data. You don't want them to, you know, just have one data point that could, you know, just be fluky thing. So yeah, we want multiple data points. We want to basically look at gains, you know, over time. We want to be able to follow that teacher. We want to make sure that we can track that those students who are assigned to those teachers are actually the right students. The schools have had problems with that in the past. So, I think we want, on the front, multiple measures sounds really good. But I think we need to sort of dig down, and that's what this report's aiming to do, and see which ones are most predictive.
Yeah, and Mike, of course, your question definitely assumes that student outcomes on test scores is kind of the ultimate student outcome. And that raises the question of, you know, are student outcomes real on test scores, or is it teaching the test? Is it really indicative of students' knowledge? And I mean, that's a whole nother story. But
right. And what Jay is arguing is, in effect, if you could just use test scores alone, maybe on multiple tests, ideally, and if you had enough data, and get just as good a read of which teachers are really good and which are really bad as combining that with the classroom observations.
Right. And I mean, the point is, I mean, and the report was very upfront about this. I mean, they had a minimum of 4 evaluations. It took multiple folks going in. I mean, that's laborious. That's expensive. I mean, there's no way around that. And how much additional predictive value do those observations add when all is said and done? Not much. Mm-hmm. Could the report have been clearer about saying that? Yes. But did it say it? Yes.
Okay. So, but the larger point remains, which is that it's really expensive to send in all these observers.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
right.
to do all this work. And the question is, are we getting much better information as a result of it? It may be That's that right. in terms of identifying, you know, if the point is to differentiate between mm-hmm. high and low achieving, mm-hmm. you're not getting much out of it. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. in terms of giving feedback to teachers that they can actually use, perhaps there's some information that mm-hmm. comes from those observations that are helpful. Though, as Jay points out, there should be information from the test that can be useful as
That's
well.
Right.
And
That's
this
right.
is where, you know, I think the question goes is, it may be politically popular to have these multiple measures, but it's expensive, and we
yes.
have to figure out if it's worth the money.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
All right, Amber. So so last week, you had our inaugural edition of our weekly question. Why don't you go ahead and tell us the results of that?
Okay, so last week we asked, on average, how much money does your local principal make? Is it A, $65,200, B, $80,400, C, $90,100, or D, $98,300? And my two co-hosts say?
$90,000.
Mike?
I'm going to go with the 80,000.
Okay. Janie, you are right. Yes, see, $90,100, and only 11% of our blog readers and podcast listeners answered that correctly.
We expect better performance next time, folks. myself included.
So this week, we're
asked, and by the way, 90K, this was a few years ago, so they're probably up into six
yeah,
figures by
that's
now.
That's right. Yeah. That's true.
Which, you know, is, look, it's not a lot of money, especially you're talking about, you know, principal
Long
of
hours,
big,
yes.
big high schools. Yeah, on 24/7, big budgets, you
principal
know,
to me is one of
staff.
Like the most undesirable jobs
yes,
I can imagine.
Seriously.
Yeah, we got to get that money up.
Yeah.
All right, what's the next question?
So we're going to give us a little shout out to Indiana. Indiana, maybe folks recall, they were our education reform idol winners. When do we have that, you guys?
In August.
In August, mm-hmm. yeah. So lots of good reforms happening in Indiana. And we even hear that the governor might have mentioned they're winning our little contest. But
yes, in his state of the state address.
State of the state address.
Love it.
So we want to know what percentage of Indiana's total state budget is allocated to K-12 education. Mm. All right. A, do we think it's 25%, B, 43%, C, 56%, or D, 63%? Our listeners can cast their vote online at www.edexcellence.net/podcast. And I'll let you know the answer next week.
Here's what's happening on edexcellence.net this week. The latest installment of the Fordham Institute's Creating Sound Policy for Digital Learning series investigates one of the more controversial aspects of digital learning. How much does it cost? In this paper, the Parthenon Group uses interviews with more than 50 vendors and online schooling experts to estimate today's average per pupil cost for a variety of schooling models, traditional and online, and presents a nuanced analysis of the important variance in cost between different school designs. Download your copy today. Over on the Education Gadfly Daily, multiple choice tests have been around forever. Kathleen Porter McGee tells us why phasing out bubble test assessments may actually be a mistake. You can join the conversation over on Common Core Watch. Did the GOP get it right on ESEA funding flexibility? House Republicans have proposed a dramatic and promising makeover of the American school finance system. Read about it on Stretching the School Dollar. Read those articles and more on the Education Gadfly Daily. And reserve your spot at the next edition of Fordham Live. On February 1st at 4 p.m., UVA's Dan Willingham, NCTQ's Kate Walsh, our very own Kathleen Porter McGee, and Ann Jones of Project Lead the Way will discuss this crucial question. What's holding back America's science performance? Join us as Checker Finn moderates this debate based around the State of State Science Standards 2012 Fordham will be releasing at the end of January. If you're unable to attend, this event will be broadcast live at 4 p.m. All this is happening on edexcellence.net this week. Join the conversation today.
To clear my head, telephone rang and you wanna chat. Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that. What up with that? Yes,
you know, for a while now, I've been looking for a way to mix a bit of Tim Tebow into my segment. And it looks like today's the day. I'm sure many of you have heard about the exciting finish to the NFL playoff game on Sunday between the Denver Broncos and Pittsburgh Steelers. On the very first play of overtime, heralded Broncos quarterback Tim Tebow hit an open receiver streaking over the middle, who caught the ball, stiff-armed the defender, and sprinted the final 60 yards for the winning touchdown. Naturally, Tebow instantly struck his now-famous pose, taking to one knee while bowing his head in prayer. Tebow fever has been growing for a while since the quarterback's first start, a miraculous comeback win in late October. Ever since, enamored fans have been striking the Tebow pose in just about every place imaginable. Included in the bunch are four high school students from Long Island who, after continuously striking the Tebow pose in the hallway, have been suspended by administrators. What's up with that? Administrators claim the students Tebowing were blocking the halls and could have potentially caused a riot. A riot? Talk about an overreaction. I'd raise the religious freedom issue here, but clearly, and admittedly by the students, there was no actual praying going on while Tebowing. However, maybe if the administration simply ignored the phenomenon and didn't discourage it, effectively encouraging it amongst contrarian students, it wouldn't have gotten out of hand. But nope, in typical American school administration fashion, they decided to overreact. As a result, hallway Tebowing grew to including over 40 students before the suspension. Come on, administrators, let's learn from the past. I clearly have, and I've only been around about half as long as most of you.
So what were you just saying, Janie, about the being a principal being about the least attractive job you can imagine?
And that's why.
And this is why they have to face these kinds of issues, and then we make fun of them afterwards for making stupid decisions.
I don't know. I'm kind of on their side this time. I mean, I can see kids in the hallway doing anything that obstructs the flow of, you know, kids traffic. I would say something. Right. Although I also think it's well in the kids' rights to then kind of, I guess, make a riot or whatever they were nervous about and have 40 of them come out and start Tebowing. I think that's pretty awesome.
I mean, they're going to have special Tebow stations. They say, well, you can Tebow, but only in these corners where nobody goes to, you know, over by the sign-up table for the yearbook or something. You can Tebow over there where there's no crowds, but not in the middle of the hallway, people.
I feel like Tebowing right now in solidarity with them.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And remember, if you like what you heard during the podcast, head to edexcellence.net/podcasts to find links and more about this episode. Till next week.
I'm Janie Skull.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C., For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.